So from the get-go, we had the view that there was no more room for fiscal imbalances because Argentina had run out of financing possibilities. So you can only have the fiscal deficit that you can finance, not the one that you want. And you have basically two sources of financing: debt, which Argentina had run out of, both international market and domestic market were already capped out, and monetary. And the monetary financing had reached a point where the risk of hyperinflation was too high.
Central bank governors are at the front lines of any economic crisis. They're there when things start falling apart and when it's time to put things back on track. Governor Santiago Balsillo has been doing more of the latter since he was appointed Argentina's bank governor in December of 2023, helping steer Argentina's economy out of years of economic turmoil. As part of the IMF's Governor Talks series, held during the spring meetings in April, Governor Balsillo sat down with IMF Western Hemisphere Department head Rodrigo Valdez to discuss what it's like to step into the governor's chair of a central bank that has been under so much pressure for so long.
So let me start from the beginning of this administration. You inherited a situation that was super tricky, a lot of imbalances. You came with a plan. What you would say are the key building blocks of that plan?
So I'm going to talk, of course, from the perspective of the central bank, so monetary and FX in particular. And to tackle the FX and monetary imbalances, we took a very basic approach of trying to separate flows and stock imbalances in both monetary and FX. So on the monetary front, you had a flow imbalance associated with or linked to the idea that the central bank was printing money constantly for two reasons: to finance the treasury and to pay interest on its own liabilities. That was a flow imbalance. And that issuance was larger than what society was willing to take. So, and that generated a stock imbalance, which is linked to all those years of an accumulated flow imbalance resulted in sterilization efforts that, in our view, had already reached a limit also.
And so just to clarify here, because you'll hear the word sterilization throughout this conversation, it refers to the actions of a central bank to offset the impact of foreign exchange or capital flows on the domestic money supply. So sterilization is a tool that central bankers sometimes use to prevent currency appreciation, for example.
Society has a certain appetite for a sterilization instrument that also has a limit. You cannot sterilize as much as you want. You can only sterilize as much as society is willing to take. So we took the view that both of them had also reached a limit, which means that when you reach that limit, if you force it a little bit, you might spiral into hyperinflation. You can see this by the monetization in real terms. So the monetary aggregates relative to GDP. The monetary base in Argentina touched a minimum of around 2.5 points of GDP in March, April of 2024, which came with the lag of the 2023 imbalances. And Argentina historically has functioned with a monetary base of around 8 to 9 points of GDP. So this was the only point in time where you saw this level of monetization was in the context of a hyperinflation in the 76 or 89 crisis. So we were very concerned about fueling that imbalance further. And on the monetary front, we faced a very interesting challenge because the debate was, what do you do? How do you make this currency relatively attractive or improve the attractiveness of this currency that society has been running from for all this time? And the traditional way is you raise interest rates and you tell people, you know, hold on to this currency because you're going to be wealthier at the end of the cycle. You're going to collect an interest on it and that's going to be better. But we knew that people had to pick their venom, as they say. So you either have more supply because of the interest I'm paying you, but you're making money on the interest, or we can make the currency more attractive by making it scarce. So that was the dilemma. And we picked the second route. So we took a very aggressive view of bringing interest rates to a negative territory in real terms, which was risky, but we banked on the fact that we had strong capital controls in place. And we figured that the scarcity proposition was going to be more attractive than the interest compensation proposition, because that one had already been played too much and the supply factor was worse than the scarcity factor. So we reduced monetary balances in real terms through the negative interest rates that were only available because of the strict capital controls. And by adjusting the FX rate, people shifted the way they looked at the currency and started looking at interest rate as an FX parity decision rather than a purely in real terms decision. So that's how we tackled that problem. And with that problem at least funneled into a solution situation, nominality started coming down and inflation started coming down. And real balances started becoming more normal, and the imbalances in this market started coming down and normalizing. And that allowed us to move forward in the next phases of the program.
Let me jump forward to the current phase. Can you elaborate a bit more now on the new FX and monetary policy framework? And a very specific question is, you used to have many different exchange rates. There are fewer now. Perhaps the question is, how much is fair to expect in terms of convergence of different exchange rates?
So as you said, we call this phase three. Every cycle there's a new phase. And we call it phase three, and this is phases because we look at this with a single objective, which is ultimately becoming a normal economy where we picked the currency competition framework, because we acknowledge the fact that Argentina is a bimonetary economy where people have already decided that they save in dollars, they use the dollar as a unit of account for long-term assets, for real estate, for cars, for wealth calculation, but they use local currency for transactional purposes. So that we decided not to fight against that. That is a reality. That is what society is doing, whether we like it or not. So we'd rather adapt policies and the economic framework to what is already in place versus trying to change the mindset or think that we can change the mindset. So with that ultimate objective, what we're going through is the different phases down a path that should take us there. And that path has to do with the starting point and the ending point, and which layers of controls, restrictions, regulations we can get rid of that will ultimately take us there. So we started off with a crawling peg, fixed exchange rate regime, strict regulations in place that basically generated, of course, parallel markets and multiple currency practices and effectively multiple prices for the same asset, which is FX. And as we move forward and we're able to get rid of some of these layers, those gaps start, we start getting rid of them and there's convergence in terms of the different prices for the single asset. So right now, we moved away from the fixed crawling peg to a free float within bands, with the idea that we want to eventually move to a free float regime, but because of the bimonetary nature of this economy and because it's been a very long period of time during which Argentines have become used to having the FX as a nominal anchor of the economy, we'd rather move into this free float regime with certain containment. So that's the role of the bands. And these bands, they have a crawling rate to them. So the upper band is moving up at a pace of 1% per month, and the lower band is moving downwards at a pace of 1% per month. So the idea of that is that we avoid the question, when are you going to free float? So it's going to come in time. there's no further phase in terms of the free flow. There's no further stage that becomes a source of anxiety and of bets of when is the next regime change. You will naturally go into free flow because the banks, you know, continuously broaden. At some point, they become relevant. The reduction or elimination of the FX gap has to do with FX restrictions. We still have restrictions in place because we still have stock imbalances. We're comfortable that the flows are already well balanced in both in the monetary market and the FX market. So much that there's no FX gap, there's virtually no FX gap. I'll talk about the existing FX gap in a second. And this changing regime, this moving from phase two to phase three, did not come with a sharp move in financial variables. So that's evidence of balances in the flows. Now, certain stocks, stock imbalances remain in place, mainly associated with multinational demand for portfolio shifts linked to dividends that have been held up during the 4 or 5 years of controls and a portion of intercompany debt. So while those imbalances remain in place, we need to keep certain restrictions in place so that we can continue moving this direction of eventually liberating them and freeing them up.
Let me ask you a bit about the recent experience from your personal perspective. In these processes, there are moments of high tension. Some things that from the outside world we think were super difficult, actually everybody in the team thought the same, no problem. And other things that are transparent for us were a source of heated debates, or even perhaps with the IMF team. So can you tell us about examples of those two things?
I like the concept of the outside world. So we're in the inside world. So, you know, in this experience, the last year and a half, there's a tremendous amount of asymmetry in two senses. One, in terms of information, availability of information. When you sit at the government, you have a grasp of what's going on in the economy that is much more detailed and much better than if you're sitting in any of the other positions, because the whole economy gravitates towards the government. So you have access to all these sources of information that none of them have by design. So that's one difference. The second one is the starting position of Argentina is so complex. There's so many layers of regulations and distortions in place that it's probably impossible for anybody to understand them completely, irrespective of which position you stand. But then you have degrees of comprehension, of understanding of these layers of complexities. And what I try to do here is Argentines are not special. They're not different. They're economic agents that just like anywhere in the world. They react to economic incentives, to financial incentives. But the starting position is different. It's the layers of complexities. So the combination of these two things makes results in the surprise factor that you feel, that you sense. And that makes it asymmetric. So most of the times when we took a step towards this normalization process, we did it when we had already a certain degree of confidence that a step forward was not going to mean two steps back. And so far it has played that way. We started out designing the program with a very strong assumption, which is we have zero credibility. Argentina has run out of credibility. It doesn't matter who is in office, who designed the program, who is saying what, zero credibility. And credibility is an extremely powerful policy tool that most governments enjoy, but we don't have that benefit. So if you have no credibility, as I said, you should only take a step forward once you're extremely comfortable that there's always going to be a risk involved, but that you mitigated as much as you can that risk. So most of the times, what surprised the market was not what surprised us, and we were more concerned about something that the market was not envisioning, that sometimes materialized and sometimes didn't. This last example was a great one. I think that I get a sense, talking to investors these couple of days, that most, you know, we have very little participation of foreign investors in the domestic market or in the international market. And because of the situation being so complex and so different from other situations in the world, people have not really taken the time to understand the details of what's going on. So you see a change in regime being announced, fixed peg to crawling bands, and you immediately think, okay, the market is going to test the upper bound. And a large number of people expected that, because they were not familiar with the technical position of the FX market as we went into the changing regime. So for us, it didn't come to a surprise that the top end of the band was not tested, but for most people it was. So our concern was never there. So that's an example of a surprise factor.
Very clear. Thinking now future, no? Medium to long run, with the band growing and growing, how you think, what are the next challenges in terms of anchoring, in terms of basically the role of the central bank in that world? It's obvious that it's too early in the game to be very precise on that, but perhaps the questions that you have for the future.
So I see two challenges that have to do with behavior, how people will adapt. So one, purely from a monetary perspective, we're moving away from the effects being the nominal anchor to, in our case, monetary aggregates. And it's a question how fast people will incorporate that and will adapt to that and will incorporate that in their day-to-day decision-making process. We had a very short and very simple example the last couple of weeks. Because of our legal framework, we had to get congressional approval before we entered the IMF program. And that made it clear to everybody that there was a risk of a potential regime change. And that triggered hedging decisions. And hedging decisions come through financial markets or through the real market, people adjusting prices of the goods just in case. And then the regime change came with, and the risks of jumps in financial variables didn't materialize. So what do you do? Do you undo the hedges? Did you lose money in that hedge? You know, how do you unwind that? And how does that affect your behavior going forward? Because in the real economy, and that's the second challenge, it's been for a long period of time for Argentine businesses, it's been a better economic proposition to hold on to inventory than to grow your business. Because in a context of negative interest rates in real terms, where you have cheap access to financing and high nominality and high uncertainty, holding on to goods was a better business proposition. Now, in the current context, I sense you're better off rotating your inventory, selling, and enjoying the financial benefit of a normalized world. But that means that you have to be willing to reduce margins. It's a different business proposition, business model. And so agents will need to adapt. So you see some industries that adapt faster, like we're looking at, we're seeing the automotive industry. Car sales in, what was it, February, I think were up like 50% year over year. So those guys are adapting, and they're selling in interest-free installments, 24 interest-free installments. The moving inventory, but some other products are not doing that. And that generates a distortion in relative prices because people that don't adapt have higher prices than what they should. So there's a relative price distortion. And it generates a distortion in terms of how balanced the economic recovery is. So I think those are two challenges.
So thank you, Governor. Congratulations for the very good start of phase three of your program. Hope that everything goes very well. Thank you.
That was Santiago Bausili, governor of the Central Bank of Argentina, speaking with IMF Western Hemisphere Department head Rodrigo Valdez. The event took place as part of the Governor Talks series held during the spring meetings in April. You can watch a webcast of the event at imf.org. And go to imf.org/podcasts or the platform of your choice to find more of these podcasts. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.